Today, Burt welcomes famed cannabis activist and politician Jody Emery. Joining him in studio, Jody shares her account of the tepid relationship between the police and cannabis offenses over the last couple of decades, and with the details of her own harrowing experience being arrested, she explains why the full expungement of criminal offenses is needed, a step up from the current pardons in place today. Frequently found on speaking engagements around the world, Jody shares her thoughts on the what, why, and how of the failed war on drugs, Canada's own history with it, and where our newfound national legalization of cannabis needs to grow and change for it to be labeled a success. We go now to Burt in conversation.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
And my guest today is Jody Emery on Friday before Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, same to you.
And Jody is a legend in the industry. She's been a crusader. She's been a cannabis activist and a business owner. She has the Cannabis Culture Lounge, but she has been involved with politics, activism. She's spent time on the other, in the dark side. Orange is the New Black. And she is a phenomenal activist within the cannabis world.
Thank you.
So welcome to the show.
Oh, I appreciate it. And that reminds me, too, I was also a magazine editor for 5 years, and that was the first thing I did, so I tend to forget about it. But yeah, been on all fronts.
Which magazine was that?
Cannabis Culture Magazine.
All right.
Yeah, one of the first.
Well, it's still out there.
And not in print, but definitely online. Yeah. We did that print work up until 2008 when the market crashed.
So the website for that is Cannabis Culture. Just Google
CannabisCulture.com.
It'll pop up online.
Yep. And Facebook, we have, I think, almost 3 million followers, which is pretty impressive, but we've got an international audience. This year marks 25 years since Mark Emery launched it all, and next year will be 20 years since Pot TV, the video website, was launched. And that was one of the first video websites ever on the internet. So we're still proud that we have live shows almost every day of every week and creating content and promoting the message.
Wow. So how did you get into this? What was the genesis? Where did, you know, in your growing up, your life journey, how did you get into the cannabis world?
Well, I often wonder how my life book will begin, the story of where I came from and why. And the first part is I hated marijuana. I hated cannabis. I hated alcohol, drugs, teenagers having sex. Everything that teenagers did, I was like, you're all bad. You're all, like, terrible, not following the rules. You're supposed to, you know, study at school. And I was very authoritarian, teacher's pet, very bossy. And my best friends started smoking pot, and I gave them so much grief about it. And that was, like, grade 9 or 10. And then they introduced me to Cannabis Culture Magazine in print and this Pot TV video website. And it was during the 2001 general election in British Columbia that the newspapers were all talking about this marijuana seed millionaire named Mark Emery, who was running a full slate of candidates with the BC Marijuana Party to promote this marijuana issue. And the tour was going to come to Kamloops with the bus driven by the mayor of Grand Forks, Brian Taylor, who was the leader of the party. And the bus was Nixon's actual election bus. So it's hilarious to see the drug enforcement badge on the inside, and it's campaigning for the marijuana
party.
Just a minute,
when you say Nixon from the United States?
Nixon from the United States, his bus driver from way back when.
The one who said, I'm not a crook?
That very same. And we had that, or I didn't, but the BC Marijuana Party had that as their official marijuana party bus. And the driver, like, from way back when, old guy, would drive around for, you know, spreading the message. So that was my first cannabis rally. But at first I was against cannabis. My friends were using it. I was giving them a hard time. I'd tell them they may as well just go stand in a burning house. You're killing yourselves anyway. You shouldn't use that stuff. So I gave them grief. But one night my parents went away and my friends came over, because I was still friends with them, and we wanted to drink beer and smoke weed. And I'd never had alcohol or anything. So I drank beer and I didn't like it, and I had shot glasses of Pilsner beer, so maybe that's why I don't like it.
Oh, good but Lord.
Bad introduction, right? But they wanted to hotbox the bathroom. I got high. I loved the music. I loved everything about it. And I started to learn more about the world through cannabis. It's a very strange way to introduce it, but when 9/11 happened, obviously massive, horrible incident, but my best friends, who were the stoners, the stupid stoners, they were like, this isn't about Iraq. This is, you know, Saudi Arabia, and this is about the military-industrial complex, and this is about war and these companies like Halliburton, and there's all this stuff going on. I'm like, how do you guys know where all the, what, like, how, you're the stupid stoners. And that was because they were watching Pot TV and reading Cannabis Culture magazine. And whereas High Times magazine was all about, you know, the weed and the fun, it wasn't very political. Cannabis Culture magazine was investigative journalism, like interviewing the president of Colombia and sending journalists to find out about the drug war overseas. So my friends who were stoners, I had to question what I'd been told. Like, you, it doesn't make you stupid. They're the smartest guys in school. So that's when I began to question everything else I'd been told. And as a student who was a leadership student who trusted authority, this was shattering my trust. And so I started to question everything else. So I've told other people this before. So a year later, I used cocaine for the first time. And I'm still in high school. It's grade 11. But I used it because I was like, well, they're lying about marijuana. So they're lying about everything else. Like, cannabis is actually medicine. And there's so many benefits to cannabis. But they're saying the absolute opposite. So I won't trust them about anything else. So that was obviously a bad turn of events. I told my parents. They helped me go to boarding school for grade 12. I was on a path to becoming a lawyer and then prime minister and all this jazz. But all sorts of other stuff happened in my life, as people have. And long story short, I was going to move to Vancouver from my hometown, Kamloops, and come here and either be a broadcast journalism student or go to flight attendant school. I wasn't sure what to do. But Mark Emery, I'd been in touch with him online, and he had the Cannabis Culture Forum so people could access information. And so I'd been online, and I came to Vancouver, and the Cannabis Culture headquarters, which was then the BC Marijuana Party headquarters, was downtown, and it's where all the activists would go and all the people in the movement would go. Like, anyone who needed money or anything, it was Mark Emery, downtown Vancouver, at this headquarters. So, like, Marijuana Policy Project, everybody depended on that back in the 90s and onward. So I remember going there and just hanging out, and Mark said, just sit here and watch. Just watch what happens. See the things people tell me. See the things that go on. Just, like, what's the word for this? Like, I would just learn from him, an apprentice kind of. He said, watch this and learn. And so I realized I liked that a lot more than going to school. And then we started having rallies. And then Mark got a sentence to 3 months in jail in Saskatoon for passing a joint. And that was in 2004, in October, or fall of 2004. Totally shocking. Nobody expected that. And because it is trafficking, just passing a joint's trafficking. So that's when he started writing prison blogs in jail. He would write stuff in his journal, and then we'd call up Pot TV and read aloud each daily journal about what was going on in there. And there were a lot of First Nations people, so there was like a sweat lodge, and he was like working to try and improve the place and clean it. And so he, and everybody in Saskatoon is reading this because it was like a celebrity writing about their little prison town. So that's when I first got to know Mark, was like he was writing these blogs, and he was writing them and reading them aloud to Pot TV, and then we needed to transcribe them. So I would take every day his hour or two long reading and put it in my computer and transcribe it, and then we'd put it on the internet. And that was one of my first jobs. So that's when I learned a lot, and I fell in love with him, and he was a total hero and leader that changed the world. So those were very exciting times. And right after that, he got out and he wanted to improve the magazine, and I gave him a piece of paper saying, here's things you should change and here's some ideas of things you could do. And he fired the whole staff in February of 2005 and brought me in and said, you're going to be the assistant editor now, and I'm going to be the editor, and we're going to make a brand new look for the magazine. There's no template. We're just going to do a brand new look for every page. And so I got sucked right into that, which was followed by my run for office in BC with the BC Marijuana Party. And then the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration of the United States government, came into Canada, had Mark arrested in July 2005. So from my first introduction, the first year in, I've got the U.S. government coming in and like following me and mentioning me in their files. So it's been a go. I've done a lot since then. And Mark had to make a plea deal after getting arrested. So that was many years of court. And I was the editor of the magazine, but he knew I was going to take over. So we got married in 2006, and I took over the head shop and the lounge and the magazine and Pot TV. Now, we never had dispensaries or anything, and his business was seeds. He had sold marijuana seeds through the magazine with a giant catalog, and no one else would sell seeds to Americans or anyone, but Mark would sell the seeds, saying, give me the money and I'll use it on activism. And he did. He gave millions away, and the U.S. government documents even say, we tracked all the money, it all went to political candidates for office and ballot initiatives. That passed to make medical marijuana legal throughout America, and all these different groups. So they verified it, but they said when he was arrested, Mark Emery is the leader of Legalization Group. And all these legalization groups depend on him for money, so now we're taking away their money, so legalization can't happen. But by then, it was too late. He'd already sent millions of seeds, started all the revolution, funded all the legal marijuana marches, presented all the media and facts through his magazine and everything. So Pot TV was the first video website ever, along with CBC News. They had launch parties at the same time to put video on the internet before anyone even had the ability to stream quality video. It was just like slow-moving images. But that was in the year 2000. So Mark was a revolutionary and led all that. And I had the wonderful opportunity of being here to help oversee that and take care of it. And, of course, going through prison, being a prisoner's spouse, especially when they're imprisoned in Georgia and Mississippi, it was not easy. So that 4.5 years was tough times, but ran for office yet again with the BC Marijuana Party, or BC Green Party, fourth election campaign. Done a lot. So as you can see, it's been quite a go, but it came from a strange origin of being completely opposed and trusting authority to finding out that they lied about cannabis and no longer trusting that authority. And so that's one of the main reasons I'm very upset the government keeps lying about it, because they're losing all their credibility with everything else. And why do they keep lying? And there's all sorts of reasons why, but it makes me very upset, because a lot of people will not believe the honest warnings about opioids or alcohol or other substances, because they've been told cannabis is bad and that's not true and they know it. And so, I don't know.
That's fascinating. Now, with that introduction, I could go so many different directions here. But if you travel the United States, do you have a problem?
I can't anymore. So as of December 18th, 2017, I took a plea deal. So yeah, I guess I didn't even touch on the whole dispensaries. When Mark got extradited, we didn't sell weed or seeds. It was just a bookstore, bong shop. And I worked very hard to make that continue going. And when he got home, dispensaries were operating. A lot of medical dispensaries were opening up because legalization was coming. You know, Trudeau was promising to legalize and license them. But also, they had just been opening up out of free market demand, and that medical patients needed access. And if you ran polls across Canada, everybody thought it should be legal, and people really liked the dispensaries. So that's when we decided Mark got out of prison, and we're like, we're broke, we're struggling, and every dispensary is selling all the head shop stuff, the rolling papers and things. So we were really struggling. We were like borrowing small amounts of money just to get by. And I was still the owner of the company. I thought, why don't we do with weed money what Mark did with seed money? A lot of these businesses are making money selling cannabis, but they're not doing any activism with it, besides Dana Larson and Dory and a few others. But like, nobody's really doing that, and every dispensary is a medical storefront. So people who aren't sick are being forced to lie and go into these medical dispensaries and talk to a doctor and pretend they can't sleep or whatever, so they feel bad. It's scamming a system. The real patients are, you know, it just brought some problems to the whole way that everything was being done. And I thought, this is ridiculous. We know that legalization is coming. Cannabis is going to be legal for all adults. Why are we forcing people to keep pretending that they need medicine? And why should anybody have to get sick before they have the right to access medicine? Why can't they use cannabis as a preventative medicine, or use it as an alternative to alcohol?
Just like, I'll let you take a sip of water
thank
here.
You.
And I'll buy you some time here. It's just like when people get up in the morning, like I do, and I take a vitamin D pill or a vitamin or an aspirin or something like that, as part of your regular program, and it should be that. Now, coming back on it though, for you though, have you applied for a cannabis store license?
Yes. So this is how our dispensary story goes.
It's on Hastings Street, correct?
Well, our Hastings Street headquarters, 307 West Hastings, we haven't applied for that location because of a few different reasons, and I'll get to it. This is quite a story, and nobody's actually had it on record yet, but I haven't had time to write a book yet, so I'll just share it with you. But
here's your chance.
Here we go. So when we, like I said, Mark got out in August 2014. 2015, we spend campaigning for the Liberals, trying to get by, really working hard. And we opened up a lounge and a head shop on Davie Street, where there was a different dispensary. Eden was a dispensary that was there. And we opened up a store and a head shop and a lounge in the same vicinity. But we had, when it was early 2016, you know, Trudeau had been elected. Everybody thought it was going to be legal. Stores were opening up. And I kept saying to people, you know, cannabis culture has been around forever, and we have this amazing brand, and everybody's looking for a brand, and we have this vision and a model, but we have no money. We've been just screwed by the government and law enforcement and court costs and everything for so long. Like, we're just broke. So why do we have a valuable brand and no money? And then you've got people with money who want to get into the cannabis industry who don't have a brand. So we thought, if we find people who want to open up a store, put our name on it, and let us be the spokespeople for that brand, and to make it known that these businesses are giving money to cannabis culture to be able to finance legalization, I'll do with weed money what Mark did with seed money. So I'll open the first stores that admit they're for all adults, no discrimination, don't need to give us your information, we don't need you to lie or anything, just come in with your ID, 19 plus, come get your cannabis. And it was a franchise model so that people could own their own in their own different locations, be a local entrepreneur, hire your own staff, but just have a brand. And so that was the vision. And every time we opened, we said, this is civil disobedience. We are breaking the law right now, like everybody is, but it's supposed to be legal, and this should be legalized, because that's what legalize it meant, legalize the weed that's here. So I did that. But in Vancouver, our first location was on Beatty Street, and it was eligible to get a license. So that's why we're like, this is great. Now let's go into the system. Vancouver's licensing and that location is eligible. It's in the go zone. So that's when we opened it up on the day, April 29th, 2016, the same day Vancouver introduced its licensing regulations. And I said, we've got a location for cannabis culture. And then the city of Vancouver redrew the map to draw just one little strip of the street out and to exclude us. So suddenly it wasn't eligible anymore. And then all these problems came up with strata because you had to go to bylaw variance. And so that one became a headache. Go to Toronto, the day we land to open up our first Toronto shops, the Toronto police carry out the Project Claudia raids. And this was broadcast all across Canada because it was a massive sweep, raiding hundreds of dispensaries. And we were literally in one of our own, just like, oh, look, we're going to paint the walls. It looks great. It's ready to go. And then we get a call, there's raids happening. So we ran down, and Eden was getting raided, and people were inside, and Vice News was there. And it was a big deal. And we're like, wow, we're going to open up a store. And they all just got raided. So there's a police station rally the next day. I go to that rally. It's for patients. We're all outside. But all of the media is inside. It's a massive raid because only 1 week prior, they had done a poll and they said the majority of Toronto residents want dispensaries, not just medical, but also recreational, and they like them and support them. So here we go, legalization, here we come. And that's when, boom, this raid happens. So all the media and everyone across Canada is like, what is going on? We go to the rally. I'm outside protesting and someone says, Jody, you should go in. I should go into the press conference. I'm like, yeah, right, they'll never let me in. I said, no, they might not know who you are. Just try. Why not? I'm like, okay, fine, I'll try. So I walk in, I see some cops. I'm like, can I go to this press conference? I mean, we hadn't opened our stores yet either, right? So I'm like, can I go to this press conference? And they're like, yeah, sure, it's upstairs. So I go up there, and it's this giant room, and there's a table with edibles everywhere and officials and cops. And it's packed with all the media. It's a giant store. And I'm there with my little camera, and Manisha from Vice is in front of me. So the police chief starts talking and saying, oh, we've taken all these dangerous edibles away. And he gives his spiel. But all the media are like, why are you doing this? It's going to be legal. Like, what are you doing? Where'd this come from? Who's calling for this? And I start asking a question. I think I asked, like, why? Who? I don't know. I said something. I don't really remember. Police Chief Saunders gets very frustrated because the whole tone of the room is like not cool. And he gets flustered. And he's like, Health Canada can explain, and brings a Health Canada rep. And they start going on about unsafe edibles or who knows what. But the media is kind of getting disgruntled. And then I don't know what happens. It's all on tape somewhere. But basically, the police chief cancels a press conference. And I'm saying something. And the cameras all turned to me. And he wanted me removed from the room. But the cops wouldn't touch me because all the cameras were live. And so I'm on video. You can look it up. It's called Global News, Jody Emery. Justin Trudeau, Liberals lied. If you look
it
up,
I'll check it out.
It's a little skit, and I'm very upset, and it's passionate, and I just basically speak a lot of truth. But that's when the investigation by the Toronto police began into me, because they were very upset, and a lot of big businesses were upset. But that was 2016, so we open our stores there, and then we come back out here, and you know, I get arrested 6 months, or yeah, 8 months, 10 months later, I get arrested in March 2017. So no more dispensaries, not doing that. A few continued to operate, but I wasn't involved anymore. And then they all got shut down, so ultimately there's none now. But the thing about Vancouver, here's the insidious part about how we're always jerked around. So we wanted to apply, and we got shut out of that location. And then we considered applying for our headquarters. We were thinking, well,
on Hastings.
On Hastings, the good old legendary 25 years. And we thought, okay, we were going to apply. So we call the city and we say, we want to get a development permit. And they say, oh, we're not doing that anymore. And we're like, yeah, the website says it's not available. And they're like, yep, not available. So then we had a meeting with what was CCI. They had just started Cannabis Compliance Inc. and some nice people that wanted to help us out. And they sat and talked with us and they said, why don't you just get that development permit? And we said, what do you mean? How do we get it? They said, well, you get it. Like, Tokyo Smoke got it. Like, and half a block away from Cannabis Culture headquarters, Tokyo Smoke had applied and somehow gotten a development permit. And we're like, well, that's strange. They keep telling us we can't. We even went in person to City Hall and asked, and they said the form doesn't exist. So we told this to a media friend here in town, and that reporter called the city and asked how to find this link, and they said, oh, you have to get the specific address, the website address. Here it is. So they kept lying to Cannabis Culture, saying, nope, nope, not available, but providing it to others. So now at this point, Tokyo Smoke down the block from us makes it impossible for us to apply because the 300-meter distance limitation. So they just sit there empty most every day being funded by endless money while we're busting our butts with rolling papers and T-shirts and stuff. And so we get jerked around a lot. And I understand it. I mean, the government has been proven wrong, and we've been the ones who have been saying what's true and right. And so, you know, they don't want to admit they're wrong, and they don't want to let us win is how I feel often. But we're still trying. We're still trying to get legal locations. Like, I'm still working on it. If Ontario opens up their application process and I can find partners with money who want to do it, we've got business models. We've got not just Cannabis Culture Lounge, which is all about the history of the movement. I mean, our stairwell is famous there. It's got 1,000 pieces of cannabis history all over the walls for two stories. And so you just get immersed in the culture and the community, which is missing from the retail stores. So Cannabis Culture Lounge is about the movement and the culture, kind of like a Hard Rock Cafe, but for weed. And then I've got my Jody's Joint Cafe, which I launched last year, and then it shut down. Oh, wait, I launched it in 2018. Yeah, I launched it. And that was a tough go, too. Cost a lot of money from people who helped me out, but couldn't make it happen when the rules changed for licensing. Just couldn't keep going. But maybe in the future, my hemp coffee shop model, you know, it was wonderful with hemp oil-stained counters and hemp wallpaper and hemp fabric seats. And I really want to promote the environmental elements of hemp beyond the civil liberties that I'm most passionate about. Environmental issues are second. So I want to get to work on both of those. And then we also have High Score Lounge, which is our retro video game arcade vapor lounge, and it's at the Cannabis Culture headquarters as well. It's every type of video game you can imagine and really fun space. So we have all these business models ready for consumption, but the rules don't allow for consumption lounges here yet. Yeah. So that's my next challenge, talking with lawyers and other business entrepreneurs. And I've got a lot of opportunities ahead to work with business and medical and dispensaries and patients, everybody, everyone who's being jerked around. We need to make the laws more fair. All the laws and regulations need more fairness in them.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I always look at how we came out of prohibition of alcohol into the real world where we have access to the product compared to how we're handling cannabis. And it's totally different. And,
well, yeah.
And the people in the cannabis world should be allowed to participate, because you folks, you know, you're one of the leaders in the industry, and you know as much about cannabis, a lot more than the government does. They should be listening to you people and folks that have experience, and they should be making it easier.
Well, and it's strange because they have, like, I've told them everything. That's what's so interesting, is people who want to make a difference elsewhere in the world will often ask me, Jody, what should I do? And I'm like, well, I've run for office. I've written letters to the newspapers. I've, you know, supported and met with politicians. I've spoken to the Senate committee. I've spoken to the House of Commons Health Committee, the Ontario Justice Committee, Toronto Police Board, Vancouver City Council. I mean, I present all the evidence, the Washington State Legislature. I mean, I present all the facts. And they don't really want to admit we're right. Like, it's a strange thing, because if the government says, you know what, you were right, we're wrong, we shouldn't have arrested people, it shouldn't have been criminal, that causes some problems. One of them is that, similar to my first time smoking weed, suddenly you question everything else. Like, what else are they wrong about then? What else is the government doing that's not right? Where else are they wasting money? And that's the other second major issue, is that the government can't really legalize cannabis properly, because the vast majority of police work is spent on drugs, and the vast majority of that is spent on cannabis. And if you look at the Stats Canada charts, it's just shocking. Police get so much money. It was $500 million that Trudeau admitted to before getting elected. They've pledged at least $1 billion extra, from $274 million federally to each province has hundreds of millions, to each city can do like $8 million to $10 million, all from marijuana law enforcement. And people have to ask, like, why do they need to enforce the law against something that's not against the law? What does legalization mean? Why is something illegal? If the government says it's okay, why is it still criminal? Why are there still raids? Why are dispensaries gone? Why can't patients get access? And people are still losing their jobs and facing stigma and not able to travel. And the whole pardons that the Liberals have promoted is nonsense, because they don't do anything to liberate people from their criminal records. But again, the government can't really say, sorry, we harmed you and that was wrong, because then you question everything else about them. And then on top of that, they're still continuing it. So they can't say, sorry, we arrested people and gave them criminal records. That wasn't fair. And then people would say, well, why do you continue doing it today? And why don't you erase the records fully? So it's a giant disaster. I've been obviously commenting for a long time about it, and I wish things would be better for everyone, because I think, you know, even though big business can sometimes be an enemy of small entrepreneurs and advocates, at the same time, they're getting really jerked around by all these prohibitions on regulations and licensing opportunities, and taxpayers are being forced to fund the whole disaster. So that's another issue that's really important to me. I hate government waste of tax dollars. I hate that we don't have adequate medical and other essentials because money is being wasted on needless policing and law enforcement. So
when you got arrested, did the police say, we got to do this, but we don't want to do this? Or how was that feeling, and what was it like to be arrested for what you did?
Well, so Mark and I were on our way to Spanibus in Spain to speak. So I would never travel with weed or anything. And that's the funniest part, is I've got this giant trafficking conviction, but the police admit I never actually bought or sold weed. I didn't do that. I was just spreading a message with a model. But it's much easier to take a trafficking charge than a conviction for a conspiracy, though. So I went with the trafficking. But I don't move weed around, but I do speak. And we're at the airport to leave.
And this is in Toronto?
In Toronto. And the cops, like, I had just been on TV earlier that day. We were just opening another store. There were 30 at our biggest, like, we had 30 locations overall. Had over 300 requests to open up stores during that time. So things were just wildly busy and exciting. And we get to the airport, and the cops stop us right as we get out of the Uber, which is, Uber is so ironic.
Well, at the departures area at the
right
airport?
As we get to the gate, we get out of there.
So they were following you.
They were ready for us. I don't know how they knew we would pull up right at that point, but even the Uber guy was totally shocked. And I always use Uber as an example of, there's some lawbreakers the government regulated quickly and fairly, like relatively compared to cannabis. But so the cops arrest us then, and Mark is like, I want to call my lawyer. And they said, well, we'll get that to that at the station. Mark's like, no, I know my rights. I want to call my lawyer. You have a phone. I want to call my lawyer. They said, no, we're in a public space. He's like, we'll get an office. They're like, no, we don't want to do it. So they didn't let us call our lawyer for like 7 hours. It took, I think, over 12 hours before we got to see a lawyer.
In the meantime, you missed your flight.
Yeah, and they were also carrying out the next morning. They were raiding all the locations. So the rest of the bust wasn't happening till the next morning. So that's why they kind of jerked us around. But it's pretty awful experience. I mean, as I was saying earlier in the studio here, I wasn't really bothered while it was all happening. It was just kind of surreal. I'm like, wow, this is actually happening. I'm actually getting arrested. I'm handcuffed, and we're going to go to jail. And that's so, it was long. It's not fun. The whole point of my activism is so people don't go through that awfulness. We don't want people to encounter the law enforcement for cannabis, but I had to see what it was like. And, you know, when I finally got to the police station, then they strip search you, and that's a degrading experience in itself. And then I find out later it's unconstitutional, and it's been ruled as such a couple times, but they still keep doing it to people. But it was also, like, it was women, and you squat and cough and the whole thing. I'll tell people, they should know. At first, like, take off your bra and your top, and then you put your bra back on, and then take off your bottoms and squat and cough, and then, they take away your bra, and then you just have a shirt. And so then I got to spend the night in jail there, and one jail guard did come up to me, and he said, I'm really sorry this is happening to you. You guys are doing the right thing. Please keep it up. And we hear that a lot. Even my prosecutor said that, which is so weird, right? So then I go to court the next morning, and just before we're about to go to court so I can get out on bail, my lawyer is like, Jody, Mark, I'm really sorry, but they just arrested more people. They arrested Chris and Aaron Goodwin in the courtroom because they're there to support us. And there are, so all of a sudden the courtroom is erupting into a scene, and I flashed a peace sign, and the judge is like, "You're not allowed to communicate." So, because that's my gang sign, apparently. I don't know. But like, so it was a scene. And then I had to go to maximum security that night because you can't just be held downstairs.
Oh, good Lord.
So that meant being on in the transport bus. And so all of that. There's a very funny story about all that, but I'll save that for another time. But I get to the jail, and that's when it's really miserable. That's when, like, suddenly the women guards were just mean, very unnecessarily mean. They were making a girl cry, and I was even like, "Do you have to be that way?" And she's like, "You watch it." And I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "Damn, this is actually serious." And you're like in a cell with all these people, and there's an open toilet, and there's blood on the toilet paper. And I'm like, "Guards, there's blood on the toilet paper." And trying to make a scene, but some of them knew who I was, and then you get a needle in your arm, and then they wanted to strip search me again. I'm like, "But I've been in your custody the whole time." And she's like, "Nope, do it again." So I'm like, "Top first, then bottom." She's like, "No, all of it all at once." And I'm like, "What the? This is okay." So you go through it, and then you get marched in the line. You're wearing jumpsuits and like baggy underwear and stuff. They give you everything. You go to the cell, and the lights don't turn off, and you can't see out, and there's no cold water, just hot or hotter water out of the fixture, and you're with someone else in the cell. And there's no way to tell time, and it's just so uncomfortable. But I knew I was going back to court at least the next morning, and that was extra uncomfortable. The girl handcuffed to me in the transport unit. These are little metal boxes, so like if you were a animal going to a slaughterhouse and you're in a metal box in a transport truck, this is what it's like. And she was handcuffed and on the ground in withdrawal, and she was quite distressed. So I spent an hour like, as she was just withdrawing and curled up on a ball on the floor. Like, it's hell. It's what they do to people. It's just a human meat grinder, the whole criminal justice system. So anyway, get to court. The judge has an anxiety attack and has to be taken away, and it's this massive scene. But we finally get out at the very end of the night. But even at the end of that night, the prison guards are like, "Why are they keeping us all here? We want to go home." And I'm like, "I don't know." And it was because they were freezing out the media that were outside in the freezing cold. And so got out after that, and you have nothing on you, and they'd taken our suitcases because we were about to travel.
Yeah.
So I had no clothing, no underwear, no nothing, and had to go to the mall, and I'm on the phone doing interviews at La Senza trying to find underwear. I'm like, it was just surreal. It was surreal, and very distressing, more so after the fact. Like little things, a beeping of a truck. You know when a truck backs up and it just goes beep? Beep.
Yeah.
Well, when you're in those transport vehicles and you're backing up to pick up more prisoners to load in, it makes those beeping sounds and you can't see anything. And it's just, so for a while that would make me worried. And then I had been arrested in Montreal briefly by undercovers pretending to be fans. So whenever there were men in parkas around me or people who said they were fans, I would constantly be jumpy. And so the PTSD lasted after that. I got my medical prescription for that. I used quality medicine for it. And I still, like, most of my PTSD now is just, like, these triggerings of rage about how people are still getting screwed over and arrested and losing so much, and people keep telling me to stop complaining and that it's legal. What are you complaining about? And it's like, I get the emails from people having their kids taken away. I get emails from people losing their jobs and being evicted. I see the stories of guys who are medical in their wheelchairs sleeping under garbage bags in the forest because they're evicted for using medicine. I see that stuff, so I get really upset about how unfair things are, but then being in that sort of mental state is impossible. It's like a surgeon or in a war, you're seeing trauma all around. You need some goodness in your life. So this year has been the year of taking care of myself. I grew cannabis at home. It's medical. It's therapeutic. It was just such a nice experience.
Four plants.
And you can, well, it's just, that's even ridiculous. If those four plants are visible to neighbors, I could go to jail for and be fined a lot of money. These rules are insane.
Well, you're experienced at that now, so you know the whole
routine. There you go, right? Like, I shouldn't really care. That's the other irony of it all. And our lawyers often joke, like, after all these years of prohibition and all these people were brave and standing up against the law, and now the government says, "We're going to give you a ticket." And everyone goes, "Oh, my God, we're going to shut down." And they freak out. And it's like this weird, is it legal? Is it not? Can you do it? Can you not? And I don't know. It's just that it messes with a lot of people's heads, I think. It's
so
a lot of drama.
We're sitting here talking during the election campaign, federal election campaign's on. How do you feel about this campaign? And do you feel that Trudeau should have said, you know, cannabis is now legal. We're going to pardon. We're going to expunge the records of everybody who's been in the past arrested for cannabis? Or
that's what he said. I mean,
what are your thoughts about this?
Well, in 2013, one of Trudeau's quotes, and I tweet this all the time. I always tweet, "Where did this Trudeau go?" and it's 2013, and he's being interviewed about why he was even considering decriminalization or legalization. So 2013, right? And he said, we don't need to consider, I forget what he said, we don't need to think about. He said, what we do need to focus on is ending the unfair arrests and criminal records that affect thousands of Canadians, and ending the $500 million law enforcement budget that's being wasted each year on enforcement. And so his whole initial angle was the right message. And then the police chief of Toronto, who oversaw G20, got put in charge of the marijuana file. That's Mr. Bill Blair. And Mr. Bill Blair oversaw G20, which is Canada's biggest mass arrest of peaceful Canadians and civil rights violations. All sorts of horrible things happen. So it was very worrisome when he got put in charge and the message started turning into, oh, wait, marijuana is dangerous. We need to protect everybody from it, and the gangs and the kids. And I'm like, the government has statistics from the Justice Department where they said 95% of all marijuana growers and dispensary operators are not connected to gangs or organized crime. The government has known this, and they keep lying about gangs and crime to justify tough rules and tough regulations and more money and more enforcement. So Trudeau originally was on the right page. And I often joked about how Mark Emery got 3 months for passing a joint, and Trudeau admits he passed a joint as a member of parliament at a dinner party. Where's his 3 months? And he admitted on Vice News when I was there, said that the laws are unfair. And so it's really weird how the Liberals, even Bill Blair said, the marijuana enforcement has been one of this country's greatest mass injustices. Like he said, it was a great injustice. And yet they continue to do it. So we're in a very interesting time with this election, because obviously there's a lot of other issues that are being talked about more than the policies and more than substantive stuff. I mean, the parties haven't even really released platforms, today or tomorrow or something.
No conversation about cannabis.
No, and it's not happening. And I think I'm just going to leave that till after the election because, you know, we were lied to by Trudeau, not just on cannabis, but a lot of issues. But I feel bad for politicians. They get in and they think, I'm going to change things. And then they are introduced to the hundreds years old bureaucracies that are deeply entrenched. And they're like, oh, that's how things go. Oh, I see. The deal was made with the former government. We can't get out of that contract. And so it's just they're basically the seat warmers and the public faces we get to get mad at. But I don't know. This is the most depressing election ever. I voted in advance today. I did, just because whenever I used to campaign and you do the Burma shaving, you know, you stand on the corner and wave your signs. And I used to always come up with different chants because that I was very loud about it. And one of them was, like, I think the election was on Tuesday. And so I'd say, your right to vote, you wouldn't want to lose it. So on Tuesday, please go use it. And I'd like to say stuff like that. So I tweeted something similar to that today with my picture outside the voting station. But so uninspired. But I couldn't not do it. Like, for a second, I couldn't find parking. I'm like, maybe I won't. And I'm like, yes, you will. You will find parking and vote, because that's a very important right. And people who are opposed to our issues vote. So we better do it too.
Jody, with what you've been through, you've got to vote. You've got to do that thing. But, you know, I find this election fascinating. We talk about the fact that Scheer's got two passports. Trudeau's got two planes. The leader of the Green Party gets photoshopped because she's got a Starbucks coffee cup in her hand. What are the real issues? There's no conversation about cannabis.
Yeah, and I often say the sad thing is either a politician will lie to your face while they're getting elected and promise you something they know it ain't true, or they'll be sincere to you and then they'll find out later, oh no, I have to change my position, and then they, you know. So I feel really bad. I've run for office. It's not fun.
A lot of politicians operate on the philosophy of saying, you know, your stories touch my heart. I really feel for you, and thank you very much. Now get out of my face and let me get on with my day.
It's so hard. It's so hard to watch. I mean, again, I've run five times, and one of them was a nomination campaign for the Liberals. But like that, it's so hard. You see the other people who actually govern and the ones in those positions, be it Hedy Fry or Libby Davies or anybody, and you know how frustrating it is for them to have to meet people with issues and concerns all day long that you know you can't do anything about. And it's even the fact, you know, confusion over political parties when we have a provincial election, and it's, you know, it was Christy Clark or something back then, and people would say, oh, I'm not voting for the Liberals of BC, I hate that Trudeau guy. And I'd say, no, you got it all wrong, not the same party. And so people don't even, those who actually pay any attention are so limited, and then they can get confused. So political engagement is really discouraging, because real leaders can't, I just feel like they can't make a difference. And that the most depressing illustration of that for me was the last federal election. You know, the NDP had been behind legalization when Jack Layton was around. He was even on Pot TV, one of the first ever internet videos with Mark saying he would do it. And then the NDP started shying away from it. And I remember, like, the Liberal Party didn't want to do it at first. And we were really discouraged because the NDP had an opportunity to promote legalization. I remember I was on Parliament Hill for the Liberal Senate meeting in 2014, I think it was, or 2015, early 2015, in the House of Commons. Jeremiah and I met with Libby Davies, and she had told us, this might have been a different Ottawa trip, but we met her in her office, and we remember saying to her, why doesn't the NDP take your issue? Like, you're so eloquent about it. It's something the party should embrace and promote. What's the issue? And she said, it's extremely frustrating. Like, I really wish I could make it more of a priority. And they all agree with it behind scenes, but nobody wants to carry it. And I remember that was just so sad and depressing. So when the election was coming around, I wasn't affiliated with any party, but I had been speaking at different town halls and events for whatever group would invite me. And the Vancouver East Liberal Association guys, they were, you know, the real underdogs, because Vancouver East is Libby Davies, 40 years. I mean, she's amazing. I love her. She helped us when Mark was extradited. But when the Liberals asked me to run, I was like, I'm not joining the Liberal Party. And they're like, no, but think about it. The legalization issue, we really need it to be a top issue, or they're just going to, like, ignore it, and you could bring attention. I'm like, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, it would be kind of fun to be that one and take a riding that I cannot win. I don't want to win. I want the idea to win. I don't want to win. But a riding I can't win where it's not a serious campaign and I get to promote that issue. And then it turned into this amazing story of me and Justin Trudeau and whether he would meet with me or not, and then the Conservatives attacking the Liberals for associating with me, and then the Liberals being like, but no, we don't associate, but we do want to legalize. And it was such a crazy year, but ultimately they gave me the red light because I just made them look bad, I suppose. But the Liberals had a chance to do it right, and I gave them every opportunity. And when Libby found out I was running, she said, why are you running against me? I said, Libby, you're going to win, and I'm going to tell people you should win, but the legalization issue is so important, and your party has failed, and you know your party has failed, and I have to push this issue, and I'll endorse you. I'll tell people you inspire me. It's the truth, and people know it. So, but that didn't really make sense to her, as obviously no political candidate should be saying, I'm going to endorse you and run against you. I mean, it's just nonsense. But also, she was tired of this, of things, and she announced that she was going to retire, but suddenly that changed everything. Like, the Liberals could have ignored me as the little pot candidate, no chance, but suddenly a riding became open, so they put a lawyer, a philanthropist, a former cop, and someone else. I think that was it, and they ran against me and gave me the red light.
Somebody who walked on water.
Yeah, so they didn't win, of course. They still didn't win it, but that was a very interesting time, really messing with the Liberal Party and not wanting to, because it didn't really have to be bad, but they didn't want to make it legal the way I was saying they should, so they kind of just needed to throw me under the bus. But when they rejected me, I still supported them, and I, you know, because it was about the message, and they failed. We didn't fail. We were deceived or whatever. But maybe it'll get better. More people feel upset.
I hope so. Now we're coming up on the anniversary of legalization. Yeah. How do you feel it's gone for the 1 year we've been into
this?
Disaster. Did you say the word disaster?
Yeah, disaster. Because for everybody too. I mean, a lot of people have made money that are opportunists, and that upsets me a lot, and I tweet about it a lot. But first of all, medical patients, their access has been all but eliminated. I mean, there have been over 500 raids by Justin Trudeau on dispensaries. A lot of new, we went from 8 federal offenses previously to 45 federal offenses, and then all these provincial regulations and laws and all these local bylaws and restrictions. And then the government stepped up their propaganda campaign, so everybody started getting scared of marijuana, and it was all the same messaging of prohibition, but under legalization. So people have been struggling. A lot of people, businesses and entrepreneurs who tried to get licenses have put all their money into it only to get bled dry by high prices the government imposes on the retail and wholesale prices. And it's just too much government interference, and they get their money because it's taxpayer funded. So a horrible example in BC is that you have your provincial government in charge of issuing licenses, but when the same government can issue a license to themselves to do a business, why would they give licenses to a competitor? And that's what's happening on the island in many places. There's First Nation groups, the Cowichan tribes, applied for a license, got their security paperwork in, everything they're supposed to do, And then the government leased a location right next to them and is opening up their own BC cannabis store instead of giving a license to the Cowichan tribes, who tried to do it the way they were told to. So the government is opening up their own stores and shutting down independent retailers. And then the government stores don't even need to actually sell their house or get a mortgage or borrow money.
We fund it.
Yeah, so that's the most infuriating part to me. It's like, how can the government get in the business where we're all paying for them to lose money? So I got a lot of issues, but we can fix them because now everybody's upset. And, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And for a while, a lot of businesses thought government was their friend. And now it's like, no, don't. Now I'm right. I've been proven right. I've been telling everyone how bad it was going to be. And now they agree with me. So now we can fix it. Because for the last year, it's been wait until it gets better. And the most frustrating thing is seeing people saying, like, well, we have supply shortages. There's not enough cannabis. And we have retail store shortages. There aren't enough stores. And you rewind to 2015-16, and it's like, we had thousands of retail stores, and we have weed. That weed supply is what's supposed to be legal. There's a lot of marijuana. It's just not been legalized. Yeah. It's still being forced to remain criminal to give police something to do and to increase the value of the legal supply so these companies can make a lot of money. And on the top of my Twitter feed, I've got a list. I call it the Unfairness List, and it's 49 different cops, politicians, premiers, prime ministers, many of them hypocrites, some of them opportunists, who are all making money from cannabis on pot stocks and legal marijuana, while the people that they put in prison are still being denied. And a phrase I often use is locked out of the legal system because your criminal record and you don't have money, and locked up if you dare try to do it without that license. And lawyers like Alan Young have said, if all you're doing is replacing one regime of criminal laws with another, then what's happened? And if you're the Canadian Civil Liberties say that, you know, they haven't legalized the culture or the industry that existed. They've only legalized a new industry of government licensed facilities selling to stores. And I mean, I'd like to make things better. It breaks my heart that so many people are struggling. And Mark and I get a lot of people in the legal industry writing us and saying, we're such fans, and we do this because you made it possible. And I even met a legal store in Calgary when I went to speak at the Faculty of Law. It was like right after Legalization Day, and there were two stores. So I went to them just to know what I'm talking about. And in one of them, they said, Jody, you made this possible. And it's such a weird compliment because I don't like those stores. So I'm like, no, I don't have anything to do with that store. It's terrible. Don't give me any credit for this system. But at the same time, this last year has been a year of trying to change my perspective and look beyond what so many people I know have lost and to try and look at what so many others have gained. So while we in Vancouver have seen the glorious model of the best it could be, the best cannabis, the best stores and experiences, you know, for many others in Canada, like walking into a store and buying weed is revolutionary. It is unheard of. They struggle to find weed. Their dealer can't come through, you know. So they go to a store and they buy weed, and that's amazing for them. And so our loss is other people's gain. You know, another phrase I use a lot recently is the glass is half full and the glass is half empty. It's the same glass. You have to choose how you look at it. So there are benefits. A lot of people think it's legal. A lot of seniors are quitting their pharmaceuticals that are harmful and using cannabis effectively instead. I have family members who are using it to treat cancer. I have so many miraculous, wonderful stories of all the benefits that are happening. And I like to think that, you know, as more and more people turn to medical cannabis, one of the side effects is, like, instead of kidney failure, you get enlightenment, or you get a sense of tolerance and peace and well-being. Yeah. And maybe this will change the world. Maybe when I, you know, we're all going to go through that thing where we start to question the government and what they said, and then we're going to become more free-thinking, and, you know, maybe it'll be that hippy-dippy revolution I wish would come around.
Yeah.
But you, when you think of the book that started it all, that started Mark Emery's revolution and many other advocates, it was Jack Herrera's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and it's the secret history of cannabis. And people might wonder what the title is about. And what it is I'm realizing it's what's happening now, is that cannabis is the child that points to the emperor and says to everybody else, he's full of it. He's naked. He's got nothing. It's all phony. It's all a farce. And everybody else who's pretending that that authority has the power is like, oh my goodness, you can't really say that. We all know it's true, but okay. So that's what the emperor wears no clothes. It's like government and all these laws and all their lies that they're protecting us for our own health is a fraud. It's a lie. And now we can see it. So cannabis is helping open people's eyes. But I really wish more people would find out about how it's a safer choice than alcohol and pharmaceuticals. You know, with the opioid crisis, there's plenty of evidence to show cannabis is a solution. I presented all the studies. You can reduce deaths by 33%. And then alcohol is devastating in so many ways to society as well. I don't want to ban it. I don't think we should prohibit it. I like a glass of wine, but
me too.
People are being harmed by it in many circumstances, and governments are addicted to alcohol revenue. One of the most incredible cases I ever saw, a literal legal case, was the Supreme Court of Canada when the alcohol industry was doing the Free the Beer with the Como case about being able to move alcohol across borders.
Yeah. Free my wine, free my grapes, free my beer.
Exactly. We should. The Canadian law, like the Charter or the Constitution, allows us to move any product in Canada. For those who don't understand the premise of this case, you're allowed to sell a T-shirt out of Nova Scotia to a British Columbian. Like, you can't stop stuff from moving. But the alcohol monopolies do. And an old man got busted buying cheaper booze and driving it across the border. So his case went to the Supreme Court of Canada to argue that the government restrictions on alcohol or the provincial monopolies governing control of it, they break our rights under the law. Government sided with alcohol because, you know, when we were at the Supreme Court, I was there as an official intervener. Cannabis Culture applied to intervene in the case.
In the Como case?
Yeah, in the Como case, we were officially accepted, and we represented 60-some-odd dispensaries, and we were saying, hey, this legalization regime that's being introduced, it's designed on this alcohol model, and that's all bad. So the new incoming cannabis monopoly, where provincial governments and alcohol boards govern all the cannabis business and wholesaling and whatnot, we said that was unconstitutional because we want BC Bud to be sent across the borders and stuff to the rest of our neighbors in Canada. So we lost that case, but I'll never forget one of the most damning parts was when the attorneys general of various provinces and territories were talking about why we can't get rid of this alcohol monopoly. And, you know, the facts are provinces like Ontario buy so much alcohol. It's like and they sell so much that it's the third biggest revenue generator or something like that.
Huge.
Like, huge amounts of government funding comes from alcohol. So the attorneys generals are standing there and saying, in none of it, you know, we have an alcohol abuse crisis. There's addiction and all sorts of problems from alcohol and other crises, but we can't pay for it unless we have the alcohol money. So they were arguing to keep selling alcohol, making alcohol money for taxes to pay for the harm through healthcare that's caused by the alcohol. And I'm standing there going, but just sell weed instead. And so we lost that case. And ironically, as Kirk Tusaw was standing there and delivering his statements, we were getting raided at the Cannabis Culture Ottawa store that was in town at that time.
Oh my God.
So the story has been pretty nuts. But it's a shame that we lost that case because now these provincial monopolies govern cannabis and they just put in so many different costs that are totally unnecessary. I believe in a truly free market where, you know, it's supply and demand and the government just gets out of the way. And if you do well, you do well. And if you fail, you fail. So,
yeah. On the Como case, my view is that it emphasizes the fact that we're not really a nation. We're just a bunch of provinces that got their own powers, and it drives us nuts in the liquor world.
Oh, no doubt.
That you can't, if you're in Ontario, you can't get a case of wine from Burring Owl shipped to you legally.
Right. No, it's madness.
It's nuts. And we're not truly a country in that regard. But I want to come back to legalization of cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
We're now into it. Edibles are about to be unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have edibles. What's your take on that? Because my take on it is it's not going very well.
I think it's going to be a tragedy and for everybody, because not only is packaging excessive already with cannabis buds, but the edibles packaging is going to be, you know, how do you put a full warning label full of nonsense compelled speech on these products when, you know, 10 milligrams is the limitation for a piece, I believe. And so a lot of issues with packaging. How are you going to present it? And then even the idea that, you know, why are they regulating these products for those that it would harm? Like, they should be regulating for those who use it properly. You know, cannabis won't even kill anybody, and there's no concern about bottle packaging for alcohol or warning labels for kids with alcohol. So the hypocrisy that exists isn't really fair. But the edible situation is a massive oncoming crisis because many, many, many medical users use edibles. They depend on it. A lot of people don't want to smoke. I love smoking. I love having a joint. For me, it's my ritual. a lot of people don't like smoke, and they want edibles, and they need high-dose edibles. So medical patients need like 500 milligrams or 100 or 1,000 milligrams or whatever they need, and the law will prohibit them from being able to get products with that amount in it.
So you're going to end up, if you need that dosage, you're going to end up eating a couple of dozen brownies.
A few boxes of them, yeah.
Yeah, a few boxes of brownies.
Or with a lot of tax excise stamps on them or whatever.
And,
yeah.
And then the other problem, I'd look at the 10 milligram thing as low, I compare it to light beer.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a true beer. It's like a light beer, and it doesn't work for people who have illnesses.
Right.
And I noticed, I was just at a speaker down at the ICBC conference at the Bayshore Hotel. Mm-hmm. And the woman who's in charge of the Cannabis Bureau for the state of California was there, and they have different THC levels, difference between recreation and medical. And we don't have that.
Right, and it's because the government doesn't want to acknowledge medical cannabis. I mean, Canada's history has been about medical marijuana patients and providers trying to get legal access, and the government repeatedly saying no. So it was like, you know, patients growing for themselves, and the government says, no, you can't do that. And then the charter rights say, yeah, you have to let people grow for themselves. And then you have patients saying, well, I can't grow for myself. I'm quadriplegic. I need someone to grow for me. So then they said, okay, a designated grower. You're allowed one more person to help grow. And then it became like, okay, can a grower then grow for more than one patient? Can they grow for four or more? And the government is always giving the least they can give. It's like, okay, fine, they can grow for two people. It's like, that's ridiculous. So nonstop, even Anne McClellan, who was put in charge of the task force, she said marijuana, medical marijuana is a scourge. Like, marijuana is a fraud. She fought against it. She was the health minister. She said medical marijuana shouldn't have any support. And then she worked for Bennett Jones Law Firm and became the head of the task force. And Bennett Jones Law Firm represents licensed producers. So the task force said licensed producers should be the only legal providers. But anyway, the liberals fought legal access. And then Prairie Plant Systems existed, where they were growing it in a mine in Flin Flon. But it was such terrible, terrible cannabis that patients, that's how they got the right to get other means of access. It wasn't enough. But then the Harper government in 2014 or 13, they opened up the producers. So they thought, okay, to deal with these court cases, will allow a bunch of companies to grow medical marijuana. Then that's when those companies started coming up, and that's when the first news stories started coming out of Larry Campbell, Senator Larry Campbell, former cop, former mayor, getting into legal business. And so all these people started getting into legal medical marijuana businesses, which only existed by virtue of court order to protect charter rights of medical patients. But all these guys started getting involved saying, hey, once it's legal down the road, these will be the only providers. And so all these big companies started lobbying the government to say, we're the medical providers, we should be the only recreational providers too. So that lobbying took place, and it's well documented. I've shared it a lot online. So that's how we got to this point, though, where medical patients are supposed to get access, but those legal producers can't sell it to a store. They can only sell it through the mail. So then the issue becomes, well, if you're a medical patient, you need a credit card. And you can't just order 1 gram or one joint at a time. You need to order a minimum, which means you need like $50 at least. And then you got to wait for it to get delivered. And oh, if you're at your doctor's appointment and you miss the delivery, then you like, it's a nightmare for access. So again, that's why dispensaries are essential. And courts regularly side with medical dispensaries, the illegal ones, is because these dispensaries can sell you a joint for $5 when you just, you know, came down the street with your walker, you know. And so that immediate access to quality medicine that's affordable is so essential. And it's the origins of the whole cannabis movement legally in the courts. And then it's been co-opted by these big corporations who have turned it into an ability to be the only legal providers and to have a captive audience where the government literally arrests their competition and puts them out of business. So medical patients have been so badly taken advantage of. And then a lot of their product is contaminated and has recalls. And for many of them, the products are just not available because the producers had to make deals with provincial wholesalers to say, legalization is coming, we'll make sure we have like 500 million pounds or whatever imaginary numbers, and then legalization day comes and they're like under-delivering and stores aren't getting supply. I mean, Canopy Growth, their own stores got supply, but the competitors did not. So, you know, there's all that sort of shady inside stuff too. But anyway, the whole, everything is unfolded in such a unfair way, but more and more people see it all the time. And even those who might see themselves as opposed to me agree that medical patients are getting screwed over with taxes. The medicine is being taxed. But again, it all goes back to the government not wanting to recognize medical marijuana. Because what happens if the government says, you're right, cannabis should be given to children to prevent epilepsy and improve the quality of life, and yet we're preventing anyone from selling weed in a store with a window you can look through or in a box you
can't,
because they killed the kids. So if they start admitting that cannabis is medicine that saves people's lives and improves the quality of life for sick people, how can it be bad for healthy people? How can they justify arresting people for something that's medicine? So that's really the crux of it all, is like, once they admit cannabis isn't that bad for you, it's actually good. I mean, that's doubly bad for government credibility. Only they can't just say, oops, sorry, I guess we didn't see all those studies that we ignored for a long time. But they're not just saying cannabis is benign. They're outright saying it causes all the issues that cannabis can actually cure and solve. So science is coming around. Another benefit of legalization, study can happen on a much bigger scale. So we're going to see benefits. But, you know, back in the 70s, they had studies showing that cannabis was a neuroprotectant that prevented cancer and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And look, here we are. I wasn't even a twinkle in anyone's eye when they were confirming that evidence. And here we are. Yeah. So I don't know how long it'll take. But part of me thinks we've reached that tipping point. You know, when the U.S. government arrested Mark in 2005, he had already been selling seeds for like 10 years. That was a lot of Americans. Like, if you're smoking weed in the USA, good chance it came from genetics Mark Emery sent into America, and your money went to fund legalization. But once all that weed was sent and then the DEAs tried to stop it all, it was too late. But Mark went to the belly of the beast, and then that's when that's actually 2010 was the year he got extradited, and I went down to California for Prop 64, which failed. Yeah. And that's why when Initiative 502 happened in Washington for 2011-12 was the vote, but Colorado and Washington put forward their proposals. And Mark's prosecutor, John McKay, district attorney for Western Washington, he had been fired by the attorney general of George Bush for not going after Muslims unfairly after 9/11. So it's good reason to get fired. But he said, the drug war is a fraud. I was wrong. I want it to be legal. So he and I did press conferences here in BC with the BC attorney general and Dr. Evan Wood saying, legalize it. So all this stuff was happening when Mark was in prison. And that revolution has happened. Like, I remember when Washington State, you know, the medical patients there said to me, why are you supporting this bill? It's terrible. It introduces new felonies. It eliminates medical access. It cracks down on driving and all these issues. We don't like it. It's not good. Legalization, don't support it. And I said to them, you guys, like, I live in BC right next door to you. California failed. If we fail to pass legalization a second time round, it's going to be a non-starter. No one's going to believe it can happen. Colorado and Washington need to say yes, so please vote yes. And I was a key part. I was an official endorser of the team, and we won. And it was a headline that just said, it's legal. And that headline goes around the world. And I said to them, once it's legal in Washington State, BC is going to have to be like, well, we should legalize too, but that's a Canadian federal law, so we better legalize in Canada because we've got a border state with legal weed. So I was like, this is super compelling. You need to pass it. And then the irony being now, you know, Canada has laws I don't like and I've been criticizing. So some Washington folks have written to me being like, so remember when you said just to take the bad laws so you can send a message to the world? How do you feel? And then I go, you're right. I'm upset because here in Canada, we've been very blessed and we are taking, like, you know, we've had many steps forward. We're taking a step back, but the rest of the world is taking 10 steps forward. Like, the rest of the world says, yo, Canada's done it, let's go. And that's going to change things dramatically. Even if those laws are all different and complex and corrupt and everything that world governments and businesses are, it's mainstream, it's legal, it's going to be like everything else. But this is a pivotal change. And again, the cannabis evangelist in me, I believe cannabis is the true life. I believe it's medicine. It saved me from antidepressants and cocaine, as I mentioned earlier. It prevents me from using hard drugs. It's my medicine. It's my lifestyle. I know so many people around the world it can help. I really want to save the environment with hemp cars, hemp fuel, hemp houses, hemp clothing. I mean, there's just endless opportunities for cannabis to change the world. And I think the best part is it'll be subversive. Like I said, a side effect of medical marijuana will be everything else is better in life and you're nicer. And then maybe people will really start to question authority and the way things are. And I think that's already happening. But I think cannabis, now that it's, you know, Mark's slogan was, plant the seeds of freedom to overgrow the government. and not an overthrow like a violent revolution, but a peaceful overgrowing where the plants just grow and they cannot eliminate it. And we're at that point. So right now the government's still trying to eliminate it. But prohibition didn't work before. Prohibition won't work now. No. Just get out of our way. Let us have it and treat each other well. And everyone's going to be just groovy.
Yeah. No, the prohibition horses left the barn.
Yeah.
We're into it, but we've got to make it better. Now, I got to wrap up here. What's next for you? What's your next game plan? Where do you see, where do you see yourself going?
You know, I'm of two minds. The part of me that's a little exhausted and frustrated and discouraged is like, why don't I just go take photos in foreign countries and turn into an anonymous nobody that, you know, just live a life of doing creative work and whatever. But then I get these messages from people begging me to not stop. And then I really, and then I do interviews and I get so passionate. I'm like, this is my calling. Like, this is my mission. I need to help liberate people. So Cannabis Amnesty is a campaign that exists right now. It's cannabisamnesty.ca. And it's being headlined by Anna Maria, this amazing lawyer in Toronto. And I had started using the hashtag Cannabis Amnesty, and I bought the domain like 2 years ago. And I was saying that the Liberal government is still arresting people while they say it's going to be legal soon, but they're still arresting people. And we need a moratorium on arrests, and we need amnesty for criminal record holders. And I said this to the Senate forum. So Anna Marie is a real lawyer, and she said, I'd really like to take this and keep going with it because we all know the racial disparity in the enforcement. We all know the great injustices. We need to bring together, like, lawyers, civil libertarian types that are working on these issues and make a difference. So she started that. I'm on the advisory board, and then all the licensed producers are like, oh, we support them too. And, you know, they're giving money to them, $50,000 here, $10,000 there. So Cannabis Amnesty is taking off and actually getting, you know, meetings with politicians, and the NDP put forward their proposal. So, of course, the Liberals said no. But then, you know, we just keep pushing and campaigning. So my next project is called Fair Cannabis, and it's called the Campaign for Fairness in Laws and Regulations. And what I want to do is make it like Cannabis Amnesty. So if you're a licensed producer who's upset about the restrictions on growing, let's bring it up with the government. Let's look at some legal cases, or let's lobby for that. Or if you're a medical patient upset about taxes on medicine, you know, there's groups like CFAM and others, Canadians for Access to Medical Marijuana. There's all these groups already doing work, but they're all kind of scattered.
Yeah, they're not organized.
Right, and some of us are opponents on some issues, you know, like some licensed producers don't want patients to grow their own, or some dispensaries don't want to allow licensed producers to advertise because screw them, you know, like there's a lot of resentment and hurt over all these years of trauma. So we have all these. And I'm in the middle of it feeling, you know, it's been a weird time. And so I'm trying to bring people together.
You're trying to pull all the bits and pieces
together.
Yeah,
and to basically say, here's a legal challenge about evictions and housing law. Or here's a new human rights tribunal challenge about employment law. If you've been fired for medical marijuana, let's like contact this group or contact these lawyers. And so I'm hoping to make that happen and make it a nonprofit organization that we can organize enough awareness for all these different issues. So no matter what your concern is with the way things are going, we've got a group, a legal challenge, a petition drive, an outreach, you know, sending letters, even having form letters. So it says, you know, does your city have bylaws that prevent smoking lounges? Here's a form letter to propose a regulation amendment or whatever.
You can allow it.
So I want to do something like this, but it does need funding and it needs. So I'm having meetings with different people over the next couple months. I feel like 2020 is going to be a good year to start anew. You know, we'll just put a lot of the old stuff behind and start fresh, because it will be more legal than it is now, and it's only going to keep getting more legal. And
yeah, it's going to loosen up.
Yeah,
and it's going to go the way of prohibition.
Right.
And I still remember the days with liquor stores. You couldn't have any sight lines into the liquor store. You couldn't have any sight lines into a bar. Women and escorts went in one door. Men went in the other door, and they were dark caverns. Now we've got liquor stores with a wide windows, chandeliers, bright lighting, and tasting. And I think the world we have cannabis will go. But, you know, Jody, there was a commercial on TV years ago about the Energizer Bunny. You remind me of the Energizer Bunny, but you're on a car battery. You know, you're in overdrive.
Yeah.
Your energy is so terrific.
Well,
and what
you.
You're doing is amazing. And just keep up the great work, because there's
you.
A whole, so much work to be done on so many fronts in this file. And you've been a crusader at it for so long.
Yeah, and I want people to know that, you know, I do get... the internet world is different than the real world. And on Twitter, I often use it as an opportunity to criticize things that need fixing. So a lot of people tend to think I'm very negative and hopeless and, you know, just to write everything off with me. But I'll never forget when I was in Ottawa for the Comeau case at the Supreme Court, and there was a little mingle with lawyers the night before and journalist people, and a journalist guy came up to me and he goes, "Oh, hey, how's it going? I'm so-and-so." And I said, "I'm so-and-so." We're talking and I'm laughing and stuff. And then he goes, "You know, you're actually really happy and friendly in person. I didn't take that from your Twitter account. You're always upset and depressed." And I'm like, "No, man, I'm always smiling and laughing, typically. Had a rough couple years there, but it's getting better." And, you know, I really, for me, my legalization activism has been based in human rights and civil liberties. Like, as long as people are being harmed by laws and rules unfairly, I can't stand that. So I'm trying to get cannabis amnesty to, when we have the election coming up, we'll know which government to lobby. So we'll know which talking points to use.
Or which two parties we have to lobby if it's a minority.
Well, there you go. Maybe we need a minority and maybe prevent anything bad from happening.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping for some connections with American groups like the Last Prisoner Project.
Yeah.
A lot of people are coming together on these issues of making things fair and recognizing that legalization should mean liberation for all the victims of prohibition. And that's really my core focus. But Mark's original activism message to everybody was, you can't be a bunch of broke, poor hippies complaining about the law. You need money and you need business. So you need to make a business, make money so you can finance the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah.
So I still have to get work, and I'm like finding all sorts of opportunities, definitely looking for partners to help grow all the business ideas I have in mind. But I hate asking for stuff too. So except for the government, I'm asking you to leave us alone.
But you're doing a lot of speaking.
Well, I did a lot more before. You know, when Mark was extradited, he was the most well-known spokesperson, and I got put into that position and got some excellent training opportunities of nonstop interview requests. So I never had to request anything, any speaking opportunity. I was always being sought out. And then when 2014, 2015 started happening and big business was getting into cannabis, I would be asked to speak at these events, and then I would say, the system you're all engaging in isn't really fair, and the government is kind of screwing over pay. And my message wasn't really like, here's the great opportunity to invest in, and here's how you're going to find opportunity. It was more like, you all need to know where you're coming from and where this is coming from. You need to know people are suffering. And so that message, it gets a little downer. It's like listening to someone who survived, you know, horrific stuff in their past going on and on and on about it. And you're like, I know, I feel really bad for you, and it isn't fair, but shut up already. Like, so that's what I started feeling about myself. And then interview requests and stuff started going down because the message wasn't about legalization and human rights as much. It was more what stock is performing well and what's an overhead value. Like, I don't know any of these terms. So that's more the message. There are more people who are experts on that. And I'm not even a cannabis expert itself. Like, if it's green and it smokes nice, I'm happy. So I'm not a snob. But when it comes to the actual, like, you know, the civil liberties issues and that's most important to me. And I really want people to focus on making that a priority. But I did speak in Santiago recently, and I am getting invites to like London and other places. And I think they're having me come to speak specifically about the justice, civil liberties, those issues that have been kind of swept under the rug for a bit. But now that a lot of people are having problems in this industry and we have this 1 year anniversary coming up, I am having interview requests, and I'm trying to remind everyone I'm not all pouty about it, but you know, just because you have to point out what's wrong to fix it. Like, you can't pretend everything's okay, and that's we cannot pretend everything is okay until everybody's feeling free and liberated.
If you're gonna fix a car, you got to know what the problem with the car is,
and you
gotta talk about it.
And that's what I'm here to do. And as I said to people, if you really are tired of hearing me speak, tell the government to stop messing things up, because then I'll have nothing to complain about, and we'll all be happy. So do the right thing, and we can all just chill out.
Yeah, well, keep going on the Twitter stuff. Your Twitter feeds are far more exciting than Donald Trump's.
Okay.
And I thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank
on
you.
License to Chill. I'd like to have you come back.
Wonderful.
Again down the road.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Keep in touch on your as things unfold, because I think what you're on is a fascinating journey.
Yeah, it sure is. In some ways, it feels like Groundhog Day. Like, haven't we been here before? But then again, it's a brand new, exciting world ahead, and I'm seeing a lot more of that, and I'm very excited. So thank you for the chance to talk about it all.
Thanks a bunch.
Sweet.
Take care.
You've been listening to License to Chill with your host, Bert Hick. This podcast is recorded live at Studio 710 in downtown Vancouver and produced by Jade Maple. For more information, check out risingtideconsultants.ca.